Hello, and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 202nd episode of the Nauticast, titled The One True Hand, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Davos 5, in which Davos argues against burning a child at the stake and takes in the news that the world is ending up at the wall. Average workday on Dragonstone, more or less.
Don't worry, Davos. Eventually we'll be talking about burning a child to stop the world from ending up at the wall. That's what I call synergy.
You know, Liz Lemon, the wall is the ultimate example of vertical integration, if you think about it. Our spoiler warning, as always, prepare to be spoiled for all five novels, the three Duncan Egg novellas, histories, interviews, the Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. Question for this episode comes from our patron Darius, who asks, will we ever see Maester Pylos again? And that's a good question. He's a tertiary character, obviously, but as we're going to talk about, he's really, he stands out in this chapter and the next Davos chapter. And from what we know, I don't think he went with Stannis to the wall. I assume he's still on Dragonstone. So what do you think? Do you think he'll ever come up again, or is his purpose served?
Yeah, very simply, boy, I hope so. I was really charmed with Pylos prepping for this episode. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of wisdom, and he had a lot of mirth with the knowledge that he was imparting to Davos and that actual eagerness to teach both the kids and Davos. Pylos really took me this go-around. So I really do hope we see again. I do think we're going to go back to Dragonstone at some point in some fashion, whether it's Daenerys or, you know, there's a cache of dragonglass, presumably, and that might be a pipeline when we prepare for the fight with the others. So I do think Dragonstone, even though it's not occupied right now with the Baratheon clan, I do think it is a point of view we are going to see again. So I would love to see, say, Daenerys, you know, interacting with Pylos, who's still in the castle. I know, you know, Ser Loras went there and might or might not be burned outside the castle. So we don't know exactly what's happening there, but I do anticipate we will see Dragonstone again. And I'm hoping Pylos is alive and is able to give us some more good wisdom like he does in this chapter.
Yeah, agreed. I definitely think we're going to see Dragonstone from Dany's perspective, not only because it's kind of it's the entry point to Westeros, it's where you land when you plan on taking over, but also because it's her birthplace. She's definitely going to have some emotional scenes coming back there. And Maester Pylos, yeah, most maesters oftentimes stick with the castle. Sometimes they go riding out with their lords, but oftentimes they don't. I assume he's still there. Dany, of course, doesn't have a maester of her own. She wouldn't really need to at this point in her story. The closest of all the characters kind of orbiting around her at this point, the closest to a maester would be Morwen the Mage, if they ever team up. And even he is kind of a rogue for those purposes. So, yeah, it would be interesting if Maester Pylos ended up working with her. I think about Maester Luwin and Theon in A Clash of Kings, when Theon takes Winterfell and Luwin says, look, Theon, I might not really like you much anymore, but I don't hate you either. And even if I did hate you, my job is to help you, so I'm going to do that. And I wonder if Pylos might have that attitude at some point towards the next faction of people to take over Dragonstone. Like, I might not necessarily like you, but my job is to do the best I can by you, so that's what I'm going to do. That seems to be his attitude here, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happens again. So, thank you, Darius, for the question. If you want to ask us questions we are forced to answer here on the Nauticast podcast, you can head on over to patreon.com/Nauticast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our sworn sword and higher tier patrons get to ask us questions and get other benefits, including early access to our episodes and multiple exclusive episodes every month. But we're here today to talk about a monolith of a chapter, a true mountain Mount Everest of a chapter, A Storm of Swords, Davos 5. So, let's jump on into the synopsis. For a moment, it seemed as though the king had not heard. Stannis showed no pleasure at the news, no anger, no disbelief, not even relief. He stared at his painted table with teeth clenched hard. Been a long time since we checked in with Stannis, but George always knows how to lock us back into a character. Nothing more Stannis than reacting to the worst thing that has ever happened by gritting his teeth and pouting about it. Stannis asks if Salador is certain that Robb Stark is dead. Sala says he hasn't seen the body, but literally everyone is talking about what the small folk are calling the Red Wedding, so Sala is willing to bet money on it, except that he's the only one on Dragonstone with any money to bet. Sala reports on the grisly details of the Red Wedding. The Freys beheaded Robb and nailed Greywind's head to his neck instead, and then they threw Catelyn in the river. They sure are going to regret that last part. Really should have put her on the ground with everyone else. At a wedding, thought Davos, as he sat at his slayer's board, a guest beneath his roof. These Freys were cursed. He could smell the burning blood again, and hear the leech hissing and spitting on the brazier's hot coals. Ro-ro. Sounds like the Freys aren't the only ones who've been cursed. Who isn't cursed in Westeros at this point? It's like Podrick Payne, and that's pretty much it. Even him. Even Podrick's been hanged by Stoneheart. Everyone is cursed. Stannis' backup singers, Melisandre and the Florence, immediately begin giving credit for the Red Wedding to R'hllor, if credit is the right word there. Stannis points out that it was Walder Frey, worst host in Westeros, who directly did the deed, not the so-called Lord of Light. Melisandre declares that, hey, God works in mysterious ways, which, as in real life, is very convenient for his followers. Stannis, however, is focused as usual on his tabletop RPG map of Westeros. He is prepared to do his least favorite thing besides talk to people, namely pardon them. After all, now that both the Starks and the Greyjoys have lost their beloved rebel kings, they'll surely turn to him, right? Right? They will not. Melisandre's voice was soft. I am sorry, Your Grace. This is not an end. More false kings will soon rise to take up the crowns of those who died. More? Stannis looked as though he would gladly have throttled her. More usurpers? More traitors? And I'm just imagining Stannis, like, withholding food from orphans and Oliver Twist. More? Melisandre says she has seen it all play out in the flames, God's own streaming service. Selyse begs Stannis to take that seriously, as the flames never lie. Stannis counters that even if the fire tells the truth, it does so in a way that seems deliberately confusing, like R'hllor is setting him up to fail as much as Robert did. An ant who hears the words of a king may not comprehend what he is saying, Melisandre said, and all men are ants before the fiery face of God. If sometimes I have mistaken a warning for a prophecy or a prophecy for a warning, the fault lies in the reader, not the book. The reader, not the book. We get it, George. All our theories are dumb and wrong. Melisandre says that pardons won't do the trick of turning Stannis into a god king. For that, he needs to show Westeros a sign of his power. What power? Stannis reasonably asks. He has a tiny army, two castles, and a treasury as empty as Zerozo and Daxos is in the show. Selyse points out that Aegon the Conqueror didn't start out with a big army or a bunch of castles. All he needed to take over Westeros was dragons. The look Stannis gave her was dark. Nine mages crossed the sea to hatch Aegon III's cache of eggs. Baelor the Blessed prayed over his for half a year. Aegon IV built dragons of wood and iron. Arryon Brightflame drank wildfire to transform himself. The mages failed, King Baelor's prayers went unanswered, the wooden dragons burned, and Prince Arryon died screaming. Really, Stannis missed his calling. He should have been an Aeswath podcaster. He should have hosted History of Westeros. Selyse says that none of these would-be dragon riders were God's special little guy like Stannis. And more to the point, none of them were willing to make the sacrifice. The boy? The king almost spat the words. The boy, agreed the queen. The boy, Sir Axel echoed. The boy, said... we're out of characters. Just pretend Patchface popped in at this point and said, the boy. Stannis says he's getting real sick of hearing about the boy. Melisandre says she's got a solution handy, and you'll never guess what it is. Set him on fire! You'll never hear his name again. Davos thinks that Stannis will still hear the boy screaming as he burns, but he knows he's better off staying quiet until Stannis remembers he exists. Melisandre, meanwhile, is going off about a prophecy of a stone dragon that she never mentioned before, because mysterious ways, you get the idea. Axel Florent, looking for some attention, goes to one knee and begs Stannis to set basically everyone except them on fire. Selyse, never one to be outbegged, goes to both knees, grabs Stannis' legs, and asks him to uncurse her uterus by sacrificing the boy, born from Robert's dalliance in their marriage bed. Stannis extricates himself from his wife's grip, saying that no matter what Robert did, the boy is not to blame. Whew, good, dodged a bullet there, moving on. Oh, no, wait, Stannis has a sexier lady to listen to. Melisandre tells the king that the boy's innocence is the point. R'hllor will be pleased enough to give Stannis his blue-eyes white dragon card. It would be a wondrous thing to see stone come to life, he admitted, grudging. And to mount a dragon? I remember the first time my father took me to court. Robert had to hold my hand. I could not have been older than 4, which would have made him 5 or 6. We agreed afterward that the king had been as noble as the dragons were fearsome. Stannis snorted. Years later, our father told us that Aerys had cut himself on the throne that morning, so his hand had taken his place. It was Tywin Lannister who had so impressed us. His fingers touched the surface of the table, tracing a path lightly across the varnished hills. Robert took the skulls down when he donned the crown, but he could not bear to have them destroyed. Dragon wings over Westeros, There would be such a... Finally, Davos speaks up. Remember Davos, whose chapter this is? He's still here. Stannis reluctantly permits Davos to talk, and the Onion Knight, I'm sorry, the Onion Lord, says that gods and men alike consider kinslaying to be a curse. Melisandre shoots back that there are no gods except R'hllor, who is cool with kinslaying, and the Great Other, who is presumably cool with all sorts of slang. Plus, as every movie trailer ever has told us, people are afraid of what they can't understand. Fair enough, Davos says, so why do you specifically need Edric Storm? Everyone hear that in the back? The boy turns out to have a name. Melisandre pulls out her campaign slogan, Only Death Can Pay for Life, and says that Edric's blood already killed two false kings. Davos points out that, here in reality, her leeches killed neither Robb Stark nor Balin Greyjoy. But he decides to stop pushing it, lest his boyfriend the king decide to send one of his murderous sperm shadows after him. Don't worry, Davos, Stannis is all out of those. No juice. Juiceless. Instead, Davos falls back on something he knows will appeal to Stannis. Being pedantic. Even an onion smuggler knows two onions from three. You're short a king, my lady. Stannis gave a snort of laughter. He has you there, my lady. Two is not three. To be sure, your grace. One king might die by chance, even two. But three? If Joffrey should die in the midst of all his power, surrounded by his armies and his Kingsguard, would that not show the power of the Lord at work? It might. The king spoke as if he grudged every word. Or not. Davos did his best to hide his fear. Joffrey shall die, Queen Selyse declared, serene in her confidence. It may be that he is dead already, Sir Axel added. I know the Florents are evil and burn people alive for fun, but most importantly, they're just so annoying. Stannis agrees with me and kicks them out, repeating his new campaign slogan, Two is not three. Davos sticks around, further annoying Stannis, who had this whole evening blocked out for brooding at a wall and thinking about how no one played with him at recess. Sire, about Edric Storm. Stannis made a sharp gesture. Spare me. Davos persisted. Your daughter takes her lessons with him and plays with him every day in Aegon's garden. I know that. Her heart would break if anything ill should. I know that as well. If you would only see him, I have seen him. He looks like Robert. Aye, and worships him. Shall I tell him how often his beloved father ever gave him a thought? My brother liked the making of children well enough, but after birth they were a bother. He asks after you every day. You are making me angry, Davos. I will hear no more of this bastard boy. His name is Edric Storm, sire. I know his name. Was there ever a name so apt? It proclaims his bastardy, his high birth, and the turmoil he brings with him. Edric Storm. There, I have said it. Are you satisfied, my lord Hand? Edric, he started, is one boy. He may be the best boy who ever drew breath, and it would not matter. My duty is to the realm. His hand swept across the painted table. How many boys dwell in Westeros? How many girls? How many men? How many women? The darkness will devour them all, she says. The night that never ends. She talks of prophecies. A hero reborn in the sea, living dragons hatched from dead stone. She speaks of signs and swears they point to me. I never asked for this, no more than I asked to be king. Yet dare I disregard her? He ground his teeth. We do not choose our destinies. Yet we must do our duty, no? Great or small, we must do our duty. Melisandre swears that she's seen me in her flames, facing the dark with Lightbringer raised on high. Lightbringer! Stannis gave a derisive snort. It glimmers prettily, I'll grant you. But on the Blackwater, this magic sword served me no better than any common steel. A dragon would have turned that battle. Aegon once stood here as I do, looking down on this table. Do you think we would name him Aegon the Conqueror today, if he had not had dragons? Your grace, said Davos. The cost, I know the cost. Last night, gazing into that hearth, I saw things in the flames as well. I saw a king, a crown of fire on his brows, burning. Burning, Davos. His own crown consumed his flesh and turned him into ash. Do you think I need Melisandre to tell me what that means? Or you? The king moved, so his shadow fell upon King's Landing. If Joffrey should die, what is the life of one bastard boy against a kingdom? Everything, said Davos, softly. Whew! Had to read it all, just some of the best writing in the whole damn story. Stannis tells Davos to fuck off before he winds up back in jail. Davos leaves the Stone Drum Tower, taking a moment to appreciate the smell of the ocean. It makes him want to set sail for home, where his wife Marya and their two youngest sons wait for him. Sadly, they are going to have to keep waiting, as Davos believes his duty keeps him here, on Nightmare Volcano Island. Speaking of which, Davos takes inventory of all the stone dragons and assorted other monsters that make up the castle of Dragonstone. Not only are there gargoyles of every variety covering the walls, but many of the buildings themselves are shaped like dragons, by some strange magical art of the Valyrians who built this place. After Melisandre's talk of stone dragons coming to life, Davos can't help but wonder if these buildings once were real dragons, turned to stone. If the Red Woman brings them to life, the castle will come crashing down, I am thinking. What kinds of dragons are full of rooms and stairs and furniture, and windows, and chimneys, and privy shafts? I gotta love Salador. Whenever things threaten to get too solemn on Dragonstone, he always livens things up. Sala scolds Davos for a while about how Davos ruined Sala's totally not evil plan to sack Claw Isle by calling it evil, which it was. After wistfully listing off all the treasures on Claw Isle like a kid who didn't get the toys they wanted for their birthday, Sala mentions that he has heard Davos has been putting a team together, Ocean's Eleven style. You hear too much, you old pirate. A smuggler had best know men as well as tides, or he would not live to smuggle long. The Queen's men might remain fervent followers of the Lord of Light, but the lesser folk of Dragonstone were drifting back to the gods they had known all their lives. They said Stannis was ensorcelled, that Melisandre had turned him away from the Seven to bow before some demon out of shadow, and, worst sin of all, that she and her god had failed him. I love that. We can forgive sorcery and demon worship, but the one sin we can't forgive? Losing. Anyway, yes, Davos has been secretly cultivating allies among his fellow kingsmen, whose enduring loyalty to Stannis is matched only by their growing skepticism about Melisandre and her god. But he is not about to spill all his beans for Sela. A certain Lycian pirate once told me that a good smuggler stays out of sight, Davos replied carefully. Black sails, muffled oars, and a crew that knows how to hold their tongues. The Lyseni laughed. A crew with no tongues is even better. Big, strong mutes who cannot read or write. Well, I guess we know where Euron got that idea. Salador San, the missing link between the best man and the worst man in Westeros. Sala changes the subject. Will Stannis allow Melisandre to sacrifice Edric Storm? Davos reaches for his finger bones, only to remember that there is burned up, as Edric might soon be. He argues that Stannis wouldn't stoop to kinslaying, but Sala reminds him that Stannis has already done just that when it came to Renly. Davos insists that was because Renly had actively betrayed Stannis, whereas Edric's worst crime is just being kind of a brat. Sala leaves him to his sophistries and returns to robbing his fellow pirates in Stannis' name, pausing only to warn Davos that he may have risen too high for his own good. Davos doesn't need Sala to tell him that. He recently confessed to Maester Pylos that, as a simple smuggler from Fleabottom, he feels totally unqualified to be Hand of the King. Pylos, the living embodiment of overeducation, comes up with some tortured metaphor about how politics is just like sailing a ship. Davos calls bullshit, and to Pylos' credit, he agrees, saying Davos' common sense is precisely what makes him valuable to Stannis. Davos still thinks the Hand of the King should be some wise lord or great knight, but Pylos points out that many hands with old names and impressive resumes still fell short on the job, whereas the lowborn Septon Barth was arguably the most accomplished Hand of the King ever. Read your history, Lord Davos, and you will see that your doubts are groundless. How can I read history when I cannot read? Any man can read, my lord, said Maester Pylos. There is no magic needed, nor high birth. I'm teaching the art to your son at the king's command. Let me teach you as well. Ah, what a mensch. Maester Croson will be proud. Davos has been taking daily reading lessons ever since, persisting despite feeling silly about how far ahead of him his son Devon is. Today on his way in, Davos passes Patchface, who Pylos has kicked out of the lessons because his bells make too much noise. Good thing Pylos wasn't at the Red Wedding. Jingle Bell would have driven him crazy. Under the sea, the old fish eat the young fish, the fool muttered at Davos. He bobbed his head and his bells clanged and chimed and sang. I know, oh, oh, oh. Man, the Little Mermaid remake is dark. Davos enters the Maester's turret to find his son Devon studying with Shireen and Edric Storm. If nothing else, Davos is happy to see his eldest remaining son coming into his own. Reading, fighting, rubbing elbows with his fellow nobles, growing his first mustache, the kind you could wipe off a little spit. Oh, and he's also worshipping R'hllor. I guess even Davos can't win them all. As for Edric Storm, aka Tiny Robert, he asks how Nuncle Stannis is doing. Davos lies and says the king is well, since the honest answer is he looks like a skeleton monster from hell, and that won't go over well with the kids. Shireen says they were reading about King Daeron I, aka the Young Dragon. Young Dragon, Young Wolf, don't call yourself Young anything. It's a guarantee you won't live long enough to become the Old anything. Devon says Daron was a badass, despite being a heathen whose soul now presumably burns in hell. Edric agrees that Daron was a badass, but not as badass as, guess who, Edric's father, Robert. Edric launches into a war story about Robert beating all his enemies single-handedly and turning them into friends. Yep, kid, that's what Knuckle Stan has hated about him. Pylos kicks the kids out at this point, so he can teach Davos one-on-one. He offers to let Davos read about Daron's conquest of Dorne, but Davos wants to focus on the messages he ought to read as hand, despite how tiny the letters are. Davos really needs glasses, like the little half-moon Homer Simpson grandpa bifocals. They would suit him perfectly. "To the five kings," read Davos, hesitating briefly over five, which he did not often see written out. The king beware? Beyond, the maester corrected. Davos grimaced. "The king beyond the wall comes from south. He leads a vast host of wildlings. Lord Mormont sent a raven from the haunted forest." Pylos underlined the words with the point of his finger. "The haunted forest. He is under attack? Yes." Pleased, he plowed onward. Other birds have come since with no words. "We fear Mormont slain with strength. We fear Mormont slain with all his strength." At this point, it occurs to Davos that this message is more than just homework. It might actually be important. He asks Pylos if Stannis has read it. Pylos says he brought it to Lord Asshole Florent, Davos' predecessor as the Hand on Dragonstone, but Lord Asshole dismissed it, saying that Stannis lacks the men to assist the Night's Watch. Davos thinks that is true, and that the mention of five kings would have pissed off Stannis, not only because he thinks of himself as the one true king, but also because there are only two kings left at this point, and Stannis is a stickler about that kind of thing. "Only a starving man begs bread from a beggar," Davos muttered. "Pardon, my lord? Something my wife said once." Oh, finally we get a line from Marya Seaworth, if only in her husband's mouth. Davos thinks back to when he first saw the wall in his smuggler days. His captain, Roro Uhoris, the blind bastard, had broken the law to trade with the wildlings. He lost his head for it when the Night's Watch caught up with them. Davos has also traded with the Watchmen since then, but he never forgot the sight of his captain's head rolling across the deck. And Davos says he was younger than Devon at this point, which makes him, what, 9, 10? Whew, that'll mess a kid up. "I met some wildlings when I was a boy," he told Maester Pylos. "They were fair thieves, but bad hacklers. One made off with our cabin girl. All in all, they seemed men like any other men. Some fair, some foul." "Men are men," Maester Pylos agreed. "Ah, the more mature, thoughtful version of boys will be boys." Davos thinks that the Night's Watch must not realize what a desperate position Stannis is in these days. Otherwise, they never would have asked him for help. Pylos confirms that neither Stannis nor Melisandre ever saw the letter. Davos thinks back to Melisandre's warning about the Long Night, and Stannis' vision of terror in the snow. He wonders if there's a connection to this wildling invasion. Does this mean Edric Storm has to play Nissa Nissa to Stannis' Azor Ahai? So close, Davos. The Nissa Nissa here is one of the other kids who were just in the room. "Give me another letter," he said abruptly. "This one is too... difficult?" suggested Pylos. "Soon comes the cold," whispered Melisandre, "and the night that never ends." "Troubling," said Davos. "Too troubling. A different letter, please." And that is the synopsis for A Storm of Swords, Davos 5. Finally got through it. What'd you think of this one, sir?
You know, after watching the sociopaths of King's Landing react to the Red Wedding in Tyrion 6, it was refreshing to relive that experience with the psychophants on Dragonstone. Davos 5 is very similar to the chapter that preceded it. A decent-ish dude reacting to the horrors of the Red Wedding amidst a sea of insanity. We're further removed from it now, by pages and by Davos having no personal investment in the Stark family or cause. But that also allows this chapter to pivot the story, to begin to look forward. The prophetic and mystical elements start to take more prominence as we gear towards Act 2 of A Song of Ice and Fire, and portents for Stannis' arrival at the Wall start dropping as well. We have to stop wallowing. Life goes on, as does this book, which is only 2/3 done.
Much as I love the Davos 4, this chapter is just as good, which makes it one of the best in the Storm of Swords as far as I'm concerned. I'm just proud of myself for doing all this in one episode, frankly. First time I've ever managed to do that with a Davos chapter. And this one doesn't build to a single moment the way the last Davos chapter built to Stannis promoting him to Hand of the King. Instead, it orbits a dilemma, the fate of Edric Storm, a.k.a. the boy, from a bunch of different angles, putting it in context magically, politically, and personally. Honestly, Davos 5 is kind of an intimidating chapter to talk about, just in how dense it is, how many different styles and philosophies George is drawing from, how much he reveals about the core ideas and images of the story, but also how much he keeps hidden. Above all, this chapter is, like the previous Davos chapter, a masterclass in dialogue. Every character is written perfectly, not only in terms of how they express themselves, but also in terms of how they interact with everyone else. And coming back on reread, it all does a perfect job setting up Davos's next, and sadly last, chapter in the book, in which everything he circles around here is put to the test.
Despite it being August, I guess it's still Red Wedding Month here on the Natacast.
Red Wedding Year is turning into Red Wedding Summer.
More like there is something we forgot to discuss back in episode 200. The name itself, the Red Wedding. There's power in a name, I've heard it said before. George, from the lips of Salador San, names his big climactic event, at the same time exceedingly simple and hauntingly unforgettable. The Red Wedding. Just gotta hand it to George, who is very good at naming people, places, and things, and as it turns out, events as well. If the small folk were calling it the, oh no, Robb Stark's not having a good time palooza, it would have a bit less juice than the Red Wedding.
Not as catchy.
Perhaps it's intentional that the author names his coup de grace here, as much of the chapter itself is about naming the boy that Melisandre wants to burn. And the whole theme of power and names will take off with Feast and Dance, especially for Arya, Sansa, and Theon, as George plays more with the names of things in his story. But yes, the Red Wedding gets its name, and perhaps its most grisly detail yet, and that's a real race to the bottom. The defiling of Robb Stark's body by placing Grey Wind's head where the young wolf stood. Whether this is true or not in the books, it makes for a compelling story nonetheless. Given the reader's firsthand experience watching the events unfold, there's no reason to doubt that the Freys and Boltons wouldn't do that to Robb. Hell, A Dance with Dragons make the Bolton men seem very likely to do so, even. The other seemingly minor, but soon to be major, Red Wedding epilogue we get here is that Catelyn Stark's body was thrown into the river. Perhaps Walder Frey's twisted homage to the Godfather, thinking Cat now sleeps with the fishes, much like Luca Brasi. But as we all know, things will go an entirely different route. But let's get to this chapter. I think at a certain point, after spending so much time with this material and analyzing and podcasting about it, things just become inherently funny, regardless if there's any humor there. Stannis Baratheon is Exhibit A, who I consistently find to be a riot now, totally bereft of humor in his own way. The chapter opens with Davos wondering if Stannis even heard the news based on how little the king reacted to it. His reaction is the exact opposite of his fellow warring king Joffrey from the previous chapter. Stannis's response is a bit closer to that of Tywin's, grim as always, but it's a whole host of different concerns that prevent Stannis from shouting any joy he might have, if, you know, joy is an emotion accessible to Stannis Baratheon at any point ever.
It's great because George even lists all the reactions Stannis could have had. Mm-hmm. Pleasure at the downfall of an enemy, anger at the treacherous methods of the Freys, relief that he doesn't have to deal with Robb himself. Each of those would make sense in their own way, coming from a different character. But the reaction that fits Stannis best is no reaction at all. Like, I'll never stop saying Stannis is the best written character. George makes every word count, in part because Stannis is not a POV character. He's not even the lead of his own story, let alone anyone else's. Because he's not a POV, he doesn't show up all that often. Like you said, we're two-thirds of the way through the book, and this is only the second time we've seen him. So the author has to work overtime to communicate what's going on with him to the reader. And George always builds these scenes around the idea that Stannis is simultaneously a hero and a villain. He's the embodiment of the human heart in conflict with itself. So on one hand, Stannis doesn't delight in Robb's death. He's not Joffrey, he's not cackling gleefully and making plans about how to defile Robb's corpse any more than the Freys already have. That's good. Stannis isn't sadistic, he doesn't love bloodshed for its own sake. On the other hand, Stannis also doesn't display any of the horror and outrage that the reader is probably feeling about the Red Wedding. And that's bad. That's alienating and off-putting. How could you have no reaction to this? That's the ambiguity that defines Stannis' character. He's not as bad as Joffrey, but he's also not as good as someone you'd want to see replace Joffrey. And we're going to see how this plays out in the North. On one hand, Stannis is clearly preferable to the Boltons and the Freys, who carried out the Red Wedding and now serve the Lannisters. That's why you get some of the Northmen, the Mormonts, the Mountain Clans marching with Stannis to Winterfell. On the other hand, Stannis still has no respect for Robb's cause, as he tells Jon that your brother crowned himself and ran off to conquer the Riverlands, like the least good faith interpretation of Robb possible. And the Northmen marching with Stannis are not going to take part in burning Weirwoods like he did at Storm's End and with the Wildlings at the Wall. In terms of what's going on here and now on Dragonstone, however, I think Stannis' non-reaction to the Red Wedding on the surface masks turmoil going on underneath. The importance of the Red Wedding to these characters isn't really political, because unlike the Lannisters in the last chapter, Stannis isn't in the position to take advantage of the Red Wedding. This basically changes nothing for him. What makes the Red Wedding important here is how it ties into the fate of Edric Storm. Two of the false kings represented by the leeches are now dead, which means Stannis is coming under renewed pressure from Melisandre and her Florent allies to give her the boy, as they call him. But that's what Stannis is really thinking about here, as we'll see later in the scene. In the previous Davos chapter, the king was adamant against burning his nephew, which is why Melisandre fell back on the leeches. In this chapter, he's more conflicted, and in the next Davos chapter, he is on the verge of giving in, when Davos makes the point moot by sending Edric away. When we covered Tyrion 6, we talked about how the horror show that was the Red Wedding on the ground via Catelyn and Arya, how that got filtered through the personal and political incentives of the various Lannisters now hearing about it. For Tyrion, it was about ammo against Cersei and yet another burden in his loveless sham of a marriage. Same thing here. We're not getting an objective, God's-eye perspective on the Red Wedding. We're seeing what it means in a different context. And in this context, it is a victory for Valor and a defeat for Davos.
Maybe Stannis' lack of reaction is because his interiority is more reactive than his facade, which is something we see play out with Davos Seaworth, who confines his shock and horror to his thoughts. It's a heavy blow to the old smugger to hear about the Red Wedding, who has to reckon with both the complete dissolution of base society, but also what it means for the mystical superstructure constructed here atop Dragonstone. The leeches and a second dead king only heightens those worries. He started this book antagonistic towards the Red Religion, and its adherents taking credit for this catastrophe won't make things any better in his eyes.
This is a Davos chapter, but early on it feels more like a Stannis Selyse Melisandre chapter, as Davos is staying quiet out of self-preservation, and George only intervenes a couple times to give us his thoughts. I think it's important that, as Salador tells us, it's the small folk who gave the Red Wedding its name. Jorah Mormont told us back in Book 1 that the small folk don't really care who's in charge so long as they're left alone, which they never are. But that doesn't mean that the small folk don't care about or engage with politics at all. Some of them join Beric Dondarrion, some of them cheer for Renly and the Tyrells, and even those who never fought for Robb Stark recoil from the massacre of the Twins. This positions the Red Wedding as something more than yet another move in the Game of Thrones. It's something that reverberates through all levels of society. As we said when we covered the event, Arya was our eyes on how the violence played out for those outside the nobility, as she has been throughout the story. And now it's Davos, the most prominent lowborn character in the story, who first hears how the small folk feel about the Red Wedding, and he feels the same way. He immediately zeroes in on what makes the Red Wedding uniquely horrible. Not just that a bunch of people were killed, but that they were guests at a wedding, defenseless and believing themselves among friends. These phrases are cursed, Davos thinks, and you get the sense he speaks for the masses. George could have just left it right there, gone right back to the dialogue. Instead, he has Davos flash back to the last time we saw him, which feels like 10,000 chapters ago. Watching those leeches burn, smelling their blood, hearing Stannis say the names. Robb was one of those names. The last one, and Stannis was visibly reluctant to say it, but he said it. And now Robb is dead. Davos's feelings here are complicated. It's not that he believes Stannis and Melisandre are actually responsible for Robb's death. As we'll see in a bit, he agrees with Stannis that Walder Frey is responsible, not any invisible god. But that he thinks about the leeches right after thinking that the Freys are cursed suggests that Davos sees a spiritual connection, if not a literal one. Stannis asked for this to happen. Whether or not it happened because he asked is less relevant than his desire, his willingness for that line to be crossed. It's like the flip side of how no chance and no choice works, that you know, you're heroic for sticking up for the right thing no matter the cost. And on the flip side of that is, if you stick up for the wrong thing, even if you're not directly doing it, you bear some penalty for that on some cosmic level. Stannis made a deal with the devil. And in a sense, he is cursed by the Red Wedding even though he had nothing to do with it. Because it makes him more open into being talked into violating another taboo, namely kinslaying.
As you said, Stannis is not so quick to credit Rollor for all this. men are men, and the Red Wedding is the act of men like Walder Frey and Tywin Lannister, more so than the gods on high. Or, God, lest Axel Florent chase me, or chastise me, rather. But while men are men, women are not men in Stannis' eyes, and thus they are mostly an enigma to him. The way he shushes Selyse and refers to her as woman repeatedly speaks to his outlook on any lady not named Melisandre. Selyse is there only as her gender, not even as a high lady or his wife, the somewhat more acceptable ways to refer to one's female partner. It even seems at times he directs comments at Selyse that are really meant for Melisandre. Like his Lionel Hutz routine about there are lies and lies, where the questions about the flames playing tricks is really for Melisandre, but he's voicing that in retort to Selyse, as if Stannis feels fine talking down to her and less so the Red Woman. This will also play out physically, as Davos will note how Stannis recoils from Selyse in a much harsher and more sudden manner than he does to Melisandre's touch. Melisandre warns that even though they cut off one head of a kingdom, two more will take its place. Axel and Selyse then yell, Hail Hydra.
I can see it, unfortunately. I can see it.
We can at least say this is certifiably true. We know both the North and Iron Islands are going to dissolve into infighting between their own High Lords. The foreshadowing may be in the fact that, with Stannis' great campaign north and his capture of Asha and then Theon Greyjoy, he is going to put himself in the middle of both of those battles.
What is that? You used to have that one pinned tweet where it's this clip from CNN, right?
Yes.
Where it's like two women talking and then Wolf Blitzer just appears in the middle. That's Stannis when he gets to the north. Just, nope, this is about me now. Pushing his way in. And this is another interesting contrast with the Lannister Council scene from the last chapter. The Lannisters stood to directly gain from the Red Wedding. Both the North and the Riverlands can now be run by their allies. It looks like they've pretty much won the war. But the great irony here is that even though two of Stannis' enemies are dead, even though he asked for the Lord of Light to make this happen, it doesn't actually help him at all. Stannis is right that both the Wolves and the Krakens are now in serious trouble, especially because neither of them have an obvious heir to step up and take over. As he says, too many Greyjoys and not enough Starks. He's also right that the lions are in the position to devour them all. The lions, the Lannisters, those animal metaphors adding to the symbolic, mystical feel of this chapter. But here's the problem. There's nothing Stannis can do to prevent the lions from devouring the wolves and the krakens, because he is also meat on that menu. The only reason the Lannisters and Tyrells haven't already finished him off is that they're waiting for the Red Wine fleet to make its way to their side of the continent. And the only reason they're not in more of a hurry about making that happen is that Stannis, once the person Tywin feared most, seems to no longer matter to the war. Whatever, we'll deal with him later. He's broken. He's done. As Stannis points out, he is still comically outmatched by the Lannisters. He holds two castles. He has roughly 1,500 men. His only major asset is Salador's fleet, and no one thinks he's going to defend Stannis to the death, if that's what it comes to. So even if the Northmen or the Ironborn were theoretically open to the idea of supporting Stannis, why would they go through with it? What would they get out of it? That's especially true for the Ironborn. They've got a bad history with Stannis, and they're also on the other side of the continent. The Northmen, as we'll see in A Dance with Dragons, are a little more open to Stannis, but they will drop him as soon as the next viable Stark shows up, namely Jon. So now we can see what Melisandre was really up to with the leeches. She says she's sorry that more false kings will arise, but really she's glad about that, because it puts Stannis into a position where he might get angry enough to listen to her about the boy. She can point to those dead kings and say, see, told ya, God is on your side, I'm the real deal, and a glorious future awaits you. But killing those kings will not be enough. She's got this kind of minimum buy-in, so now she can try to use that to lure him into more and more.
Melisandre defends her misreading of prophetic visions by saying, hate the player, don't hate the game. Even if she errs, the prophecies always come true. Though, just in my opinion, it's kind of equally important that the prophecy seer know how to interpret those visions as much as actually seeing them, but That's what makes me a skeptic along the lines of Sir Davos. Another flagrantly ironic line I found in this portion was Melisandre telling Stannis that he must show power, that he can't rely on, quote-unquote, envoys and leeches, which makes me think about how Tywin Lannister orchestrated the Red Wedding, with envoys in the form of ravens and the Leech Lord front and center.
That's a great point. Yeah, it worked for Tywin. Why wouldn't it work for me? Melisandre has to do this delicate dance because of how her visions came back around to bite Stannis in the ass in the last book. She told Stannis in Clash of Kings that the flame showed her Renly smashing his host at King's Landing. Stannis moved against Renly first, in part to prevent that from coming true. But he wound up making it come true, because what Melisandre actually saw in the flames was Garland Tyrell wearing Renly's armor, pretending to be his ghost. So Melisandre not only misinterprets what she sees, her visions actively contributed to Stannis' downfall at the Blackwater. She's desperate to get around that now, and for good reason, because that mistake could unravel her whole crusade. If she mistook Renly's armor for the man himself, who's to say it was really Stannis she saw defying the dark with Lightbringer? Who's to say it couldn't have been Jon or Dany or both at once, the way visions tend to do? She used the leeches to restore her credibility, but the reader is supposed to pick up on that discrepancy and realize that, even beyond the visceral horror of what she's asking Stannis to do, she can't be counted on to deliver the rewards if he went ahead and did it.
Stannis' road to Stone Dragons is supposedly through the boy, and I had to actually count this out. From the point where Stannis incredulously says, "the boy," in response to raising dragons, Stannis, Melisandre, Selyse, and Sir Axel refer to Edric as the boy 9 times before Davos, after asking permission to speak, finally says, "the boy, Edric Storm," on the 10th instance. There sure must be power in a name, as these grown-ass adults can't even mention it while talking about whether it's okay to kill an innocent boy in hopes to do the impossible. Stannis says he hears Edric's name roaring in his ears while Melisandre offers to silence them, and my mind goes to the poor lambs bleeding in Clarice Starling's head.
Mm-hmm. It's a great motif for this scene. The boy, the boy, the boy. Same with the alliteration when the Florents are talking to Stannis and Axel says, "let the false and fickle feel the flames," and Selyse calls Edric the foul fruit of their fornication. It has a rhythm to it. You get the sense it's written to be spoken aloud. Fitting what I was talking about in the last Davos chapter about how theatrical this storyline is. I can totally imagine this scene on the stage. I love the Silence of the Lambs comparison, especially it's lines up so with Melisandre said is, "yuck, I'll take the Silence of the Lambs away," just like Hannibal would, though. I think George is also riffing pretty hard on Shakespeare here, that line of Stannis's, "his very name is a roaring in my ears and a dark cloud upon my soul." You got the kind of the dread and darkness you get in Macbeth, and you get that matched up with the storm imagery from King Lear. And one of the reasons Shakespeare's works continue to inspire is his understanding of the psychology of power. How people take on roles and identities that demand they transcend their own fears and desires, which they almost always fail to do. And that's the dynamic here. Melisandre and the Florents are claiming transcendence. "We're going to rise above our rivals. We're going to rise above all the other figures in history who tried this. We're going to be the best that we can be." But the reality is that they're feeding the worst kind of feelings. Envy, resentment, a lust for power, all of it taken out on the innocent. Selyse is trying to get Stannis to sacrifice Edric by reminding her husband that Robert and her cousin conceived Edric in their marriage bed before they got to it. It's a primal kind of betrayal, one that perfectly expresses the grudge Stannis always held against Robert. Dany calls Robert the usurper, and he usurped his brother's marriage bed as much as he did the Iron Throne. Robert in his prime was a larger-than-life personality, the protagonist of reality. And while Ned was able to find himself a place at Robb's side, kind of like Kevon did with Tywin, Stannis always felt overshadowed by his handsome, popular older brother. Not only did he have the better hunting bird, not only did he give me the lesser castle, but he had sex in my marriage bed before I ever touched it. Stannis still holds onto that resentment, as he does all the rest, admitting that he thinks, yeah, maybe Robert did curse our marriage bed, maybe that's why I have no sons. But Stannis also reiterates what he said in the last Davos chapter. Regardless of what Robert did, Edric can't be held responsible for the circumstances of his own conception. And that's Stannis clinging to the idea of justice. Good acts and bad acts should each get their own reward, he told Davos, and Edric hasn't taken any action to judge here. Melisandre does her little ethical judo flip where she declares that Edric is a worthy sacrifice, oh, because he's innocent. That just makes him tastier to God. But really, it doesn't seem like that argument convinces Stannis on its merits, which is good because it's an evil argument with nothing at all to back it up. What's really happening here is that Melisandre is seducing Stannis, both literally and figuratively. Like you said, the king is much harsher to his wife than his prophetic mistress, and Davos knows why, because the Red Woman is a literal smoke show. Stannis makes fun of Robert for being such a slut, but as with everything else, Stannis is jealous of Robert's easy way with the ladies, and he's trying to make up for lost time with Melisandre, although unlike the show, we never directly see them have sex. But she's also seducing him in terms of dragons, because that's what really appeals to Stannis here. Not R'hllor's will, but bringing back the dragons. It would be a wondrous thing, he admits. And we agree, because we already saw it happen with Dany. It's a miracle. And even sour, grouchy Stannis can't deny that it would be a powerful thing to witness. Stannis, of course, was born long after the dragons died out. Who knows about Melisandre? She might be old enough to have gotten a glimpse of him. But he was alive during the last Targaryen king, when the dragon skulls were still adorning the walls of the throne room. And he flashes back to his childhood. He was so young that Robert had to hold his hand, which is a detail I love. That's a rare moment of vulnerability for both of them. And it's a reminder that Stannis is so resentful, not because he always hated Robert, but because he used to love him, his big brother. And he feels like that love was never returned, except in little moments like that one.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to unpack in Stannis' story about visiting King's Landing and seeing Tywin, not Aerys, as king on the Iron Throne. It would be understandable if someone made that same mistake even now, as Tywin is the de facto king while Joffrey is off cutting himself on his own rule. Stannis seems to be in some awe of the dragons, which is not something we see often, and that he likens it to Tywin Lannister is something else too. But, like, I get that connection, because Tywin Lannister is among the few humans who give dragons a run for their money in terms of the war crimes they've committed.
Right, Balerion's looking at the Red Wedding like, nice work, bro. That's good stuff. Yeah, I love this bit where Stannis pulls the rug out and reveals it was Tywin on the throne. That's so fitting in a lot of ways. Tywin was the one really in charge of Westeros at that point, and he's the one who's really in charge right now. It also echoes Jaime sitting on the Iron Throne after killing the Mad King, and Cersei's dream of sitting on the throne. The Lannisters, one way or another, they all covet this power. But it's also such a pointed move on George's part, coming right after the Red Wedding, and Tywin's attempt to justify it. We have just gotten this unforgettable display of who Tywin Lannister really is, what he's willing to do in order to maintain this image of impressive authority. And now we learn that young Stannis admired him, looked up to him. So despite the fact that Tywin and Stannis are currently at war, they have a lot in common, like you said earlier. And this suggests that Stannis, too, could be talked into an atrocity like the Red Wedding. Obviously, burning Edric is nowhere near the scale of the Red Wedding, but there is still the horrible sense of betrayal and suffering. As Davos thinks, Stannis may not want to say Edric's name, but he will hear the kid scream as he burns. This is the moment where Stannis first actively considers sacrificing his nephew to R'hllor. And George is framing it in the context of both Tywin's legacy and the Targaryen's legacy. Robert took the skulls down, Stannis says, but he couldn't bring himself to destroy them. Because they were beautiful, or maybe because they still felt alive at some level, like Tyrion has said. Frozen jaws straining for you, empty eyes catching the torchlight. They've been waiting, the miracles, the fire made flesh. And all you have to do in order to bring them back is feed flesh to the fire. Dragon wings over Westeros, Stannis whispered. There would be such a... And he never finishes that sentence, because Davos finally speaks up. But I think we can guess what Stannis was thinking, what he was about to say. There would be such a wonder, there would be such a terror, there would be such a transformation of my fate. Maybe it's worth a little fire and blood.
Stannis gives us a little snapshot of failed Targaryen hatchling attempts, starting with Aegon III, aka the Dragonbane, and his nine mages, who I presume above all else desire power. That failed, giving further oomph to his nickname, the Dragonbane. The attempt seemed to get even more unhinged from there. Baelor just very sanely prayed for them to hatch, while Aegon IV constructed one out of wood. I wonder what happens to wood when it's on fire. While Arya and Blightflame decide to skip the whole egg part of the process and drink wildfire himself. Personally, Arya and Blightflame going out like that is one of the greatest unforced L's in Westerosi history. But Davos reads his liege lord as well as anyone. Just as it seems that Stannis is about to convince himself that dragons may be worth the sacrifice, our Onion Knight finally interjects himself, albeit with permission. He internally says a prayer to the new gods before facing off against the even newer god. He points out the kinslaying aspect of sacrificing Edric Storm, points out that tenuous correlation of leeches to regicide, he points out the baser half of Edric Storm's parentage. I'm pretty sure Davos doesn't think any of these points will stick, but through them he can repeat Edric's name over and over again, so that his humanity can't be abstracted from the debate at hand. Ultimately, it's basic arithmetic that helps Davos make his case. 2 does not equal 3, which any king, smuggler, or fool can grasp. Though, as an aside, in my undergrad comp sci logic class, we actually had to do proofs explaining why 2 does not equal 3, and it is not that simple, nor is it fun.
That's the next Davos chapter, is just a big chalkboard, and I'm just doing all the proofs on him.
He's going to end up being Charlie from Always Sunny, like, this is how 2 does not equal 3. The part that really adds a dash of humanity, of doubt, of that human heart in conflict with itself, is that Davos doesn't actually deny that the Lord of Light has power. He's seen it, or seen something he confuses with it. But even here, he is parsing the substance, even if it's a shadowy one, versus the metaphorical shadow on the wall, which include Melisandre's glamours and sleights of hand and all those little tricks that make men think she has more power than she actually does.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There, she's trying to make herself look more powerful than she is, and Davos is kind of doing the same thing. It's this really well-written argument in which both people are dancing around the point. Davos steps forward to speak, which, as Stannis says, is the whole reason he made Davos's hand in the first place. That's the driving factor in Davos's social ascension, his good and honest counsel. He calls on the warrior to protect him from Melisandre's god, an invocation of gods that you see at the start of an epic like the Odyssey. And yet Davos doesn't start with what is actually his central point, that Edric is a person and has inherent worth that can't be violated like this. He knows that's not going to play with Stannis, so he saves it until the end of the scene in which Stannis directly asks him what Edric is worth. Instead, he keeps emphasizing his humility, in contrast with the Florence outsized ambitions and certainty. And he admits, as he will in his next chapter, that he doesn't really have a comeback for Melisandre in terms of the metaphysics. He has seen material proof that her religion has power, whether or not there's actually a god behind it all. And he doesn't want to risk getting assassinated by another shadow baby. You get the sense he's a little bit traumatized by the last one. Davos argues that kinslaying is taboo, but that alone won't stop Stannis given the precedence of Renly. Davos argues there is no greatness in a bastard child, but I don't think even Davos believes that. Davos is less making a specific argument than trying to sow doubt, reasonable doubt, in legal terms, that Melisandre is making an airtight case. And Melisandre has to make that case built on implications and hypotheticals, because there is no fiery hand descending from the sky to do God's work. So she has to make the spurious connection between her leeches and the dead kings. And when she says that Joffrey's death would show the Lord of Light at work, all Davos has to say in response is, or not. There is no literal, unambiguous connection, so the power resides where they believe it resides. They have to make a choice. Or more accurately, Stannis has to make a choice and really, really doesn't want to. Davos finally falls back on the reality that the third leech is kind of lagging behind the rest. Joffrey is still inconveniently alive, as we suffered through last time. That's a winning argument for the moment, because there is no mysterious godly will at work. It's more transactional, just 2 is not 3. That's how Stannis prefers to look at R'hllor. We make a deal. The problem with that, as Melisandre immediately sees and exploits, is that it sets up Stannis to agree to sacrifice Edric Storm if Joffrey does indeed die, and 3 becomes 3. Davos hasn't won a moral argument about the nature of their decisions, the nature of Edric Storm as a person. He's won a technical argument about whether Melisandre has delivered on the dead kings yet. So much of these Davos chapters are about debate and rhetoric, how you use words to shape power. And Davos is learning how to do it, even if he's not perfect at it.
Davos lingers after Stannis dismisses the rest of his retinue so that he can continue to hammer home Edric's humanity, namely through his connection with Shireen, Stannis' only child. Edric even asks after Stannis Daly, something we will see play out later in this chapter. My second favorite Stannis line in these books, and one of my favorite lines from anyone, is, "Great or small, we must do our duty." Off the bat, it's a great Stannis line. You can hear it in Stephen Delane's voice. But moreover, it feels like an organizing principle to Stannis' life, from Proudwing to his unyielding hold on Storm's End during the siege. Duty is unheralded, conflicting against desire, but necessary action for some greater good. More recently, I've been thinking a bit harder about the concept of duty. There's a Yale professor on human rights and intellectual history named Samuel Moyne, who's written some books about how quote-unquote rights, whether in the U.S. constitutional sense or a human rights sense, may not be an adequate framework for assuring equality and material security for everyone, that duty to our fellow humans, to our communities, to our planet, is necessary for justice. human rights are often treated as one-to-one with morality in the discourse, that it is a fundamentally good framework for assessing and doing, well, good. But this idea is a relatively new occurrence in the history of intellectual thought. The use of quote-unquote human rights, as we often use it, really took off in the West in 1970s. You know, the reactionary 1970s that followed the radical 60s, an era in which most of the leaders of the civil rights and black and queer radical movements in the US were killed or imprisoned. The progenitors of neoliberalism went on to forward a notion of human rights, which makes us all witnesses to suffering. Famine in Eastern Europe, starvation in Africa, military dictatorships in Latin America. But don't ask anyone who put those dictators there. All these things we can point out as quote-unquote human rights violations to feel like we are just and good people who recognize true evil. But it does very little to materially secure those who are suffering. We see victims, but no victimizers in the words of Norman Solomon. We have the means to help these people, not to mention that we in the global north put these people in harm's way for our own profit. So maybe leaning on rights as a moral plea isn't enough. Maybe we need to start raising our voices that we do owe each other more, to be safe and fed and sheltered. And maybe the right to own a gun or drive a car or run a small business shouldn't be the driving moral calculus of society. Now, let me be clear. Stannis Baratheon is not waging war against Western capitalists. He is thinking about burning a child. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to highlight a certain sexiness in thinking about duty in a modern, progressive way. If you asked me 10 years ago, I would have said duty sounds like some dusty chivalric bullshit. But now I think there's something more to the idea. And maybe it's not Stannis Baratheon's vocalizing the virtues of duty, but rather the Davos Seaworths of the world that I'm banking on to ultimately do their duty, to do good. What's the life of one bastard boy? Everything, says Davos. One life is worth a million. It's evocative of the quote from the Talmud, "He who saves one life saves the entire world." That famous line is heard at the end of Schindler's List, but it also appears on the gravestone of Shayun Sugihara, a Japanese emissary who was in Lithuania when World War II broke out and was able to help smuggle 6,000 Jewish people away from Hitler. His heroics weren't even known in Japan until the end of his life in the 1980s. All this speaks to morality being more than just a numbers game. Or maybe to mash up Sir Davos Seaworth and Sir Roger Ebert, it's not about what you win, but how you win it. You can see how this sort of thinking goes hand in hand with saving the realm to win the throne, this and the sort of choices Stannis and Davos will have to face vis-a-vis Shireen and Rickon Stark, respectively.
Really well said across the board, man. That's great. And there's a reason I read this part in full during the synopsis. It's George's most extensive and effective exploration of Stannis' character, and how it fits into the larger questions of the story. George perfectly balances this, I think, allowing us to understand and even admire aspects of Stannis' worldview, while still filling us with dread and doubt about where it's going. Again, we get this great rhythmic pattern to the dialogue, as Stannis keeps cutting Davos off with, I know that too, never letting him finish a sentence. Partially that's just Stannis' antisocial behavior, which George plays for laughs more often than not. Great example of that in this chapter is everyone else leaves the room and Davos sticks around and Stannis just looks up and goes, why are you still here? Which is just, that's not a thing like someone in charge should ever say to anybody who works for them, obviously, but it's just very funny that Stannis is like, thank God, no one around, ugh, there's still a person I have to talk to. My day is not over. I already did something today. But Stannis is also interrupting Davos here because he knows what Davos is going to say. Davos is appealing to the king's humanity by pointing out Edric's humanity. Your daughter, remember your daughter, the nice thing in your life? She loves Edric. Her heart would break if you killed him. And hey, he's a good kid. He asks after you every day. That last one comes in response to Stannis yet again bringing up Robert. As with Renly, Stannis is projecting his grievances with Robert onto Edric, the sins of the father made manifest. Edric looks like Robert, as Stannis says, and that really is a sin in Stannis' eyes, although he pretends otherwise because he knows it's irrational. That's why he's lashing out at Davos. Not because he thinks Davos is wrong, but because he fears Davos is right. George is building on the relationship between Ned and Robert in Book 1. Here we have another Baratheon king and his hand-slash-best friend, or only friend in Stannis' case. When Robert was ordering the execution of Daenerys, Ned argued against it basically the same way Davos argues against the execution of Edric here. And Davos finally gets a full line to himself, finally gets to say something without being interrupted by Stannis when he says his name is Edric Storm, sire. And as you were saying, that really shows the power of the name, that they're avoiding thinking about him as a person with his own life, his own future, his own ability to feel pain. They were trying to avoid thinking about that and keep it in more abstract terms. And Davos is not letting Stannis do that. So then Stannis launches into his big speech, which, again, great way to establish his character, that this is both a hero's monologue and a villain's monologue at the same time. It's a speech about saving the world from the Long Night, which is something we've been waiting for someone to do since the literal beginning of the story. But it's also a speech about human sacrifice, about lives being treated as currency and collateral damage within a utilitarian framework. It resonates because it frames this kind of decision not as an outlier unique to Stannis because of his desperate position, but as the kind of decision that is the foundation of power. Stannis is right, I think, when he says that Aegon the Conqueror would never have gotten that name without dragons and the willingness to use them. And this speech, for me anyway, definitely hit home all the more so after Oppenheimer, because it's the kind of thing those characters were talking about a lot in the build-up to and the aftermath of the nuclear bomb. Stannis' talk about how he's willing to sell his soul and about how he saw the prophetic image of a king being set on fire by his own crown. And I love when he says, yeah, I don't need Melisandre to interpret that for me or you. That's obvious. I know exactly what that means, and I am going ahead with it anyway, because that's the kind of person I need to be. But the question is, who is that person exactly? Who is Stannis trying to be? And something I think George does really well is show us the discrepancy between the idea of Stannis as Azor Ahai and the idea of him as King of Westeros. You can make the case that the former needs the latter, that in order to save the kingdom, you need to be in charge of it. That's what we saw in House of the Dragon with the titular Song of Ice and Fire, and part of what George is doing here is showing us the story of the Targaryens, who used to have this island, in microcosm. That's why various Targaryens keep coming up in these Davos chapters. They're the precedent for what's happening now. But Stannis doesn't directly make that argument here. Instead, he slips back and forth between political and magical concerns like he doesn't see a difference. He begins by talking about his duty to the realm. He has a responsibility to save those lives from the White Walkers. And if living up to Melisandre's prophecies is how he's going to do that duty, then he'll do it by any means necessary. But then suddenly, he's talking about the Blackwater and Aegon the Conqueror. He's talking about using a dragon to take over Westeros rather than using it to, you know, melt the ice demons and their zombie army. And when the scene reaches its climax, he says, "What is one bastard boy against a kingdom?" Wait a minute. Not against the whole world, not against the human race, but against a kingdom. Those are still the stakes for him. That's what this is still about. So put aside for a second the question of whether it's worth it to sacrifice one child to the fire in order to save the rest from the ice. That's kind of a self-serving way of putting it for Melisandre. What if Stannis is only embracing that idea because along the way, it would allow him to fill the hole inside left by his brothers? What if he's only interested in saving the kingdom if it would help him win the throne? And I think those questions get at a deeper question. What is exactly the relationship between the Song of Ice and Fire and the Game of Thrones? What are we supposed to take away from the premise of a civil war taking place under the shadow of Armageddon? I think Stannis, more than any other character, shows us that relationship. On one hand, we can rise above the war in order to address the apocalyptic threat that could destroy every faction. On the other hand, there is no getting away from our individual fears and desires. There is no getting away from ourselves. So even when Stannis shows up at the wall and declares that the others are the only enemy that matters, the wildlings are our allies in that fight, he still will only accept them as such if they bend the knee to him and his god. Because even messianic fantasy heroes do not exist outside the social context that produced them. And because war makes monsters of us all. The structure is there with Dany as well, because she's the one who actually has dragons instead of just thinking about it. So the implications here are really more important for her. I think her arc was truncated in the show. I think it was missing some crucial aspects, especially young Griff as a more kind of popular rival. But it still got this idea across that the story doesn't end when you save the day. That's what Robert found out when he took over from the Mad King. Instead, what happens is you have to decide what that saved world is going to look like. Dany returns to King's Landing once the others are defeated. And when the others refuse to show up to fight Stannis, he just kind of shrugs and resumes the war. It's not even that the Game of Thrones is more important than the Song of Ice and Fire. It's that it's older. Before mankind ever tamed the dragons, before we ever met the children of the forest, we were brothers killing brothers. and the only thing we guarantee by ending the Long Night is the continuation of that struggle. We can't improve the world just by saving it because it remains the world that doomed itself in the first place. The core of Davos's argument to Stannis is that if he sells his soul in the process of saving the world, he will have made himself unworthy of leading that saved world, something Stannis is willing to consider given his vision here. Basically, Davos refuses to see people as collateral damage. That's what links Edric Storm to the sons he lost on the Blackwater. When Melisandre visited Davos down in the dungeons, she told him Stannis needed to lose on the Blackwater so he would be humble enough to listen to her. Not only did that not work, forcing her to set up this whole farce with the leeches, but it also frames everyone who burned on the river as acceptable losses. Now, more than that, necessary losses, part of the inevitable narrative weight of destiny. Davos rejected the idea that his sons were no more than a lesson for a king, which is an insight about class structure and story structure at the same time. He argues that human lives are inherently worthy. Edric's life is important and needs protection by virtue of existing. He does not need justification. That's what he tells Stannis here, and it's just such a beautifully written scene.
Yeah, and that was very beautifully said on your part, sir.
Oh, thank you.
You really took me with your dialectics between A Song of Ice and Fire and The Game of Thrones. You might as well name yourself Poor Hegel going forward.
I love it.
Really wonderful, really wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you, buddy.
The concept of duty lingers in Davos's mind as he leaves the king's presence. His heart desires a return to sea, a return to his wife and youngest two kids, but duty has him stick with Stannis. Duty moves him to Master Pylos's study to continue his literacy exams, or lessons, rather. We've talked about the eerie, creepy aesthetic of Dragonstone, and Davos takes a moment here to drink that all in. The castle really does live up to its name, down to its great hall being a dragon's gullet. The most powerful location branding this side of Barby's house. Earlier, Davos admitted that he couldn't deny the power of R'hllor after what he'd seen, and I think two of the Valyrian craftwork of Dragonstone also inspires that awe, that the impossible can be possible with or without Ethan Hunt. And thanks to Emmett mentioning Oppenheimer earlier, I think we've covered all our big July movie releases.
Good job, us.
George's Gothic imagery comes to life. The stone gargoyles and queer creatures ornamenting the Valyrian stronghold listed off in detail before that aforementioned branding of dragon everything comes into view. Towers named the Windworm and Sea Dragon Tower make me once again want to praise George's ability to name things.
Oh yeah, Dragonstone is one of George's best settings. Up there for me with Winterfell and Harrenhal. Winterfell is what it looks like when you control fire to help people. Harrenhal is what it looks like when you unleash fire to destroy people. Dragonstone is both and neither. It's caught in between, which is what makes it such an eerie and unsettling place. It's a place where fire has become ice, in the sense that it's frozen. All those dragons forever poised in mid-leap, transformed into buildings and gargoyles. Whether or not that's literally what happened when the Valyrians made this place matters less than the feeling that they did. The skin-crawling sense you get in all these Dragonstone chapters that they're all just, like, kind of walking around in some humongous creature's back. Some primeval beast that's always on the edge of waking up. And that volcanic vibe links back to Stannis because it represents his fury. But it also speaks to a larger cycle. It's in the name of the place. It's in the Dance of the Dragons, where Rhaenyra begins and ends her reign, in one of the most intimate, horrible acts of violence in the whole Westerosi saga. Dragonstone is a transition point, literally in that it's the launching pad from Essos to Westeros, but it's also a place where human beings become something else, whether that something else is kings or dragon food or sometimes both.
Amid the talk of magical masonry and kraken horns with Salladhor Saan, we learn Davos is making allies and recruiting men where he can. Kingsmen, he calls them. This is good. Coalition building, and especially in light of how the Queensmen act, Davos will need numbers and loyalty on his side. Davos has been advisor to Stannis for a long time, but he's really starting to emerge both as a character and a player of the Game of Thrones. Not that he wasn't prior to this, but as we've talked about before, his initial authorial purpose was very much driven to be eyes on Stannis. But now we're seeing him make allies, doing so with caution, and we see him learning how to read. He's actively taking steps to become a player, which we will see in full effect in A Dance with Dragons. And it's a lot of backroom operating, behind-the-scenes work, muffled oars, and smuggler's talk. This activity sticks out after the first half of the chapter, wherein Davos held his tongue and said very little until he was compelled to speak. Just like R'hllor, Davos operates in the shadows.
Earlier, I was comparing Davos to Ned in terms of Ned's relationship to Robert, Davos' relationship to Stannis, but this is really where George builds on that in an interesting new direction. Back in Book One, I drew from Stephen Atwell's great essays to argue that Ned's big mistake wasn't really about his values, his desire to save the children. His mistake was that he really didn't understand how the royal government worked and how his rivals could make use of it against him. Then we got Tyrion as Hand in Book Two, and he builds on that. In some respects, he's smarter than Ned. He fires Janos Slynt immediately. He gambles on Varys instead of Littlefinger, which in the short term is smart. But he also leaves himself vulnerable to everything being stripped away. Tyrion just makes too few friends and too many enemies. What makes Davos different, as a Hand of the King and as a hero, is that he is determined to survive in the world that he saves. He is willing to sacrifice his life if he has to, we'll see that in his next chapter, but he'd really rather not, thank you very much, and he takes steps to make that possible. Davos emerges over his last few chapters in A Storm of Swords as George's ideal politician, the one man in Westeros who manages to do the right thing and the smart thing at the same time. The irony is that Davos wasn't raised to this life, as he admits throughout this chapter. His only immediate reward of lordship is anxiety, as his crippling self-consciousness as a smuggler turned to knight has only gotten worse as a smuggler turned to knight turned lord. Look back at that scene between Davos and Melisandre when they're arguing. Selyse and Axel are still in the room at that point, but they never address Davos. Yeah, they don't need to for the scene to work, of course, but it could also demonstrate their contempt for him. The Florence treat Davos' appointment as an embarrassment and a joke. They can't visibly have a problem with it because it was Stannis' call, but they basically refuse to engage with Davos from this point on, except for when Axel tells this story about an ape that a prince adopted and dressed up in A Dance with Dragons, which really sums up how they feel about him. Kevon Lannister at one point refers to Davos as that smuggler Stannis keeps, which seems to be how every noble outside Dragonstone looks at this. Some baffling indulgence that only makes sense to Stannis and isn't representative of anything else. No one notices Davos himself. No one makes the connection to a wider ethos of service and self-risk. The idea is that Davos embodies, advocates for, lives out. So Davos has no mentor. He has no social network to call upon. He has no personal example of lordship he can look at except Stannis, who has managed to make his entire class hate him. That forces Davos into a position in which his unique political gifts wind up asserting themselves, as they do when Sala abandons him in A Dance with Dragons, and Davos is forced to talk his way out of execution, first at Sisterton and then at White Harbor. What made Davos a great smuggler, as he reflects here, is that he could always tell about people. He knew who to trust, and with what, and how much. As often as not, that comes down to luck, as Davos has always acknowledged. There are no old, bold sellswords, as Brown Ben Plum says in the next Dany chapter, and Davos' career was always about running from a straight fight. He had to know who would turn him in and who wouldn't. If he didn't, Davos would have been dead long before Stannis had a chance to judge his fate. So he picks the right people. The people who are still loyal to Stannis, but not Melisandre. That's the needle he has to thread. Because Davos, unlike his predecessor with Stannis' hands, the Lord Asshole Florent, Davos doesn't want to undermine the king, let alone surrender his sovereignty to the Lannisters. So Davos has to create a faction of men like him. Not pragmatists, exactly, because I think surrender really is the pragmatic option at this point. Davos needs true believers of a different stripe than Melisandre's followers. People who believe that following Stannis can be better than this, so they have to make it that way. Davos seeks out people whose backstories and reasons for being here line up with that organizing principle. People who follow Stannis as the last Baratheon, rather than Azor Ahai reborn. People who have stuck with the faith of the Seven in a way that hasn't gotten them burned alive, at least not yet. Just like how Brienne is the truest of knights despite not being a knight, Davos is one of the most effective politicians in A Song of Ice and Fire despite not being born a lord. It makes me think of what Dennis Malister tells Sam towards the end of the book, that really he should be the next Lord Commander of the Night's Watch instead of Cotter Pike, because I know what it means to be a lord. I have that birth and blood and early training that can ne'er be replaced. Here with Davos, George shows us that's bullshit. You can learn, and you can put your instincts from your old life into practice. And then, yeah, the Salador is always a breath of fresh air, not only in terms of being the only person who's enjoying themselves in these chapters, he's the only person having fun, but he also complicates things morally. because George doesn't romanticize his actions. Like, sure, Sala is, he's well-spoken, he's fun to be around, but he is still a pirate who is only here because he can steal shit, ideally from people who can't fight back. And yet he is also the person who told us about Nissa Nissa. He's the person who told us that the real horrifying cost at the heart of the Azor Ahai monomyth that Melisandre has still never been fully honest about. And Salador is also the person here who finally calls Stannis a kinslayer. Like, he does it in the least aggressive way possible, just through implication. Oh, Stannis wouldn't kill kin, Renly would be delighted to hear this. But still, that is saying it, and Davos is forced to respond to it. And once again, George pivots on ambiguity here. On one hand, Davos is right that Renly was a grown adult willingly taking his life in his hands. Like, Renly's last words were spent declaring total war on his brother in the name of which one is stronger. And then he got killed. Edric, as Stannis himself has pointed out, is a literal child who has had no control over any of this. If Stannis really is all about justice, like Davos keeps saying, if that's really the reason he should be king as Robert's legal heir, then how can he possibly justify this? Wouldn't burning Edric make Stannis the guy everyone was always worried he was? Someone with no guardrails left on the inside? Salador says only that Davos will have to learn the answer to that question. It's academic for him, because he is both legally and economically distinct from Stannis in a way that Davos is not, as again we'll see when they part ways in the Dance with Dragons. Sal's men saved Davos after the battle, but he can't save Davos from this, the precipice of moral choice. Davos is basically back on his rock. No one left but his own conscience. Not even his finger bones are left, as he realizes again. No luck to count on, only his own actions.
Salador parts ways with Davos by recommending the Jamaican film, The Harder They Come, which implies the harder they fall, or in Sala's exact words, the higher Davos climbs, the further he has to fall. Wait, I'm sorry, Salador. Are you saying that chaos is a pit? Now I'm thinking they should have given that climb monologue to Lucien Musamadi instead of Aidan Gillen and his confused accents. But Sala's words are also evocative of John Connington, who himself thinks about his fall after grasping for a star he couldn't quite reach. This is a common theme for most of our point of views, honestly, especially, say, Jon and Cersei and Daenerys, who will find themselves risen so high and feast and dance, only for that fall to come very quickly. And one key thing binding all these characters, ironically enough, is their isolation. John and Dany grow more distant from their advisors and subjects, while Davos feels like he doesn't belong in this world of thrones and sorceresses and dragons. But now we get to my favorite part of the chapter. Not the best, but my favorite. I am so in the bag for Maester Pylos. He's like the opposite of Sir Ryman Frey, who sucks. Mm-hmm. Pylos is a good young dude who is here to help steer Davos just as Davos steers his ships. He almost frames it in the Ironborn way, that every captain is a king on his own decks, hoping seafaring will connect with Davos. He's being an encouraging mentor figure, all while being half Davos's age. This is my third Davos episode now, and I feel like each one has offered us a list of history to parse through. We already got failed dragon birthing earlier. This time we get famous Hands of the King, good and bad, as Pylos explains that the history of the position is a land of contrasts. The two examples that clearly shout to the reader in 2023 are Otto Hightower, played wonderfully cruelly by Rhys Ifans in House of the Dragon, and Septon Barth, perhaps the best to ever do it per Fire and Blood. It's no revelation that George loves reading, and from Tyrion to Jojen to Sam, he has many characters to voice his love of books through. But damn, Maester Pylos really charmed me here, with his kindness and his love of reading history. I feel like he deserves a little more love in the same way we talk about Jojen's Readers Live a Thousand Lives line, or how we talk about Roderick the Reader. Pylos is now on that level for me, his anyone can read rejoinder making me think of Auguste Gusteau from Ratatouille arguing anyone can cook, and Pylos actually follows through and helps Davos on his path to literacy. And yes, let me echo Pylos again. Read your history, Lord Davos. If some of the historical bits I share on this podcast seem like I might be regurgitating something I learned 2 days ago, well, bitch, I might be. Learning about history can be liberating. Not a dusty tome of names and dates, but the messy conflict of ideas, made manifest in individuals and systems, systems that further propagate and propagandize themselves. Back during Cat 6 with Patrick, we talked about how history is not inevitable, that there's no one way it has to be, and that at the core is how history can be liberating. Some of the most impactful individuals in our own history have been lowborn or barely qualify as literate by our own standards. Who says Davos is not cut out for this? That his pedigree is of no use? Why can't he be a great hand? It's a beautiful sentiment, and one I feel hits harder in these Davos chapters given how George can put the Onion Knight's trials and doubts in the context of Westerosi and Targaryen history, which has happened in spades in these last two Davos point of views.
I love that Pylos's first response to Davos is this just plainly ridiculous metaphor about how sailing a boat is just like running a government. It's exactly the kind of abstract pretentiousness you would expect from a graduate of the Citadel. Like, I think about Armin the Acolyte and the prologue to A Feast for Crows, very kind of, like, nerdy, by-the-book guy who hasn't really thought about how that kind of translates into real-world practice. But even more than that, I love that Pylos doesn't get defensive when Davos points out that this is maybe the least helpful thing ever said by anyone. Instead, Pylos turns it around and says, yes, okay, that's what you just did. That's what you can do. Like, your willingness to call bullshit, that's what makes you so valuable to Stannis, because no one else will do it. The Florents are sycophants, and Melisandre is manipulative. Only Davos will look the king in the eye and tell him the truth. We saw that with Claw Isle in his last chapter. It reminds me of what Syrio told Arya. I was reading those Arya first book chapters, because Girls Gone Canon has been doing such a great job of covering them. We were talking about those later Arya chapters in the first book. And Syrio tells Arya that, I became the first sword of Braavos not only because of my skill with a sword, because, you know, there were lots of great warriors, especially in Braavos. What made Syrio different is that they were all brought in, the candidates, one by one, to look at the cat on the Sea Lord's lap and describe it. And Syrio was the only one who refused to lie. Everyone else assumed, okay, I'm supposed to say something. I'm going to flatter the cat. I'm going to call it beautiful, just a perfect little guy. But Syrio, who's, you know, confirmed dog person, called it just a cat. And that's why he got the job. Davos is down on himself, convinced that Stannis has made a mistake and that Davos will eventually just let his king down in front of everyone. Pylos tells him otherwise. And I love what you said about the liberatory effects of reading, because George is demonstrating that on multiple levels. Reading brings Devon together with higher-born kids, and it can close the gap between Davos and those born to the noble life. It's a practical way of accessing power. No magic involved, as Pylos says. No, you know, rare blood needed, no fancy family name. It's just information, which, as Varys told Tyrion, can be more valuable than gold in the right hands. Not only that, but Davos can learn, by reading, that he might be the man for the job after all. Why not, when Ryan Redwine failed miserably his hand? Apparently, we don't know how, but apparently he did. But humble Septon Barth succeeded. Reading can be a way of getting outside ourselves, critically examining the conventional wisdom we have inherited, and asking if it really makes sense, given human experience and people who have gone before us. So reading is not only a marker of class identity in Westeros. It can be a way to change your identity, challenge those structures, armor yourself in knowledge. It's part of Davos's arc as a politician, becoming a lord while never forgetting having been a smuggler, which leads to some really rich scenes in The Dance with Dragons, like when he writes that letter to Mary and says, I was a better smuggler than a knight, a better knight than a king's hand, and a better king's hand than a husband. Like, I've tried to be all these people and I feel like it's not working, but the very fact that he can write that letter at all suggests that he's getting something out of it.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it's sad. I mean, if someone taught him to read when he was 8, he could have been the Shakespeare of Westeros by this point. Davos also gets a genuine proud father moment here, taking a big sip from his number one dad coffee mug as he watches his son Devon learn and read and write with a princess and a royal bastard. What more, his son is quite good with pen and sword and apparently even God too. Even so, there's a twinge of sadness as Davos's remaining children remind him of the ones he lost on the Blackwater, the ones he has lingering guilt over sailing into the Maw of Hell. Edric's greeting to Davos always cracks me up. How is the king? The boy asks, and Davos wants to say, he looks like shit. Do not ask. The old knight has enough tact to lie, of course. Mm-hmm. Edric is all up his dad's ass, though, taking over teaching duties from Pylos to inform his fellow students about Robert winning 3 battles in a day, something we also talked about in the previous Davos chapter. It's a very childish showing by Edric. My dad could beat up the young dragon. Like me saying I could beat up Hercules if he ever stepped up to me. But I do think the childishness is the point. Here mm-hmm. we have the boy, whose fate was being determined in the first half of the chapter, very much acting the boy. this little kid is who they are debating sacrificing. And then you realize Shireen is sitting there next to him. Davos thinking of her as a sad, sweet, gentle child is no mistake ahead of what we expect to see in The Winds of Winter. And a quick side note on the Robert stuff, as much as I hate to do it, I think I gotta ding Pylos for buying into the quote-unquote official history of Lord Tyrell beating Robert, and not the more likely tale of it being Randall Tarly's doing. On the other hand, though, if this is Pylos' way of steadfastly refusing to hand it to Randall Tarly, well, that I can support.
It's like with Joffrey making fun of Tywin. Can only be a good thing.
But circling back to history chat, I've beat the it's not inevitable horse enough, but there's a whole other aspect. Just about everything we see now in our political reality has happened before. When, for example, Americans say this country has never been more divided than it is now, that's just factually not true. When we talk about times being unprecedented, it's only in flavor, not in kind. Pandemic, economic depression, and a flailing and failing imperial state have long occurred in concert. It's just now that involves people yelling at their underpaid Uber Eats driver. The point, I think, is made clear with the young dragon, King Darren, a boy king with an impressive military record who was betrayed and died before sniffing the age of 20. Sound familiar? What happened to Robb Stark is both an abomination, but also not entirely unprecedented. And I think, again, George invoking early deaths for boy kings is working in tandem with what's going on with Edric and Shireen, two young children with royal blood in them.
Absolutely. Definitely pointed to have both Edric and Shireen there. Like Davos passes Patchface on the way in, and the prophet says that under the sea, the old fish eat the young fish, which is exactly what Stannis, the old fish, is considering with Edric, the young fish, and will go ahead and do when it comes to Shireen. Pylos literally exiles Patches because of how noisy he is, but on a metaphorical level, I think it's because Patchface embodies a different kind of knowledge than book learning. Young Devon frames his brother's fiery deaths on the Blackwater as an ascension to the light of the Lord. Patchface puts it differently. That was the old fish eating the young fish. This is basically intergenerational cannibalism. Davos sacrificing his sons to the fire, like you said. We get more of George's perspective on reading and history here, as the kids interpret what they read differently depending on what they care about. Devon stresses that Daeron the Young Dragon, yeah, he's really cool, but he worshipped false gods, which seems kind of unfair given that he never even had the chance to choose Valor. But hey, that's how you stay in line on Dragonstone these days. You gotta make everything fit the shining path that the fire worshippers mention in Davos's next chapter. Devon says that Daeron was a great king otherwise, but was he? You could easily argue that his invasion of Dorne was a colossal mistake, a waste of money and blood. But no, Devon thinks that was awesome, it's just the worshipping the Seven part, that was the problem. It all depends not only on what you read and how it's written, by what you make of it, what you bring to it. In other words, it's just like what Melisandre said about prophecy, an interaction between a book and a reader. Edric filters everything through his hero worship of Robert, even though, as Stannis said, Robert didn't really care about the kid. For Edric, Robert is almost more like a character in a story, an idealized image, than he is a flesh-and-blood father who would probably have disappointed him in person. Davos is about to engage in this same interpretive process, trying to account for his own bias, trying to find the signal in the noise, when it comes to the letter he reads from the Night's Watch.
Sadly for me, Davos rejects all the good history books and prefers the newspaper, which, you know, old scrolls sent to Dragonstone. This was another fun sequence, realizing what the letter is as Davos struggles but succeeds to work his way through it, plowing ever onwards into words of doom. When realization hits Davos, he immediately asks if Stannis has seen this, knowing its great consequence. He starts tying together the vision Stannis speaks of, the portents Melisandre heralds, and we in reread mode see the narrative breadcrumbs leading Stannis to the wall. Davos recalls his brushes with the wall in the past, namely sailing to Eastwatch and further north besides, passing by the island of Skagos, which is history Davos will repeat in The Winds of Winter. He recalls the goods he traded with the wildlings, including obsidian, which we anticipate some kind of connection between fighting the others and the dragonglass caches on Dragonstone. The most important observation, of course, is Davos noting that the wildlings are pretty much like any other bunch of folks, to which Pylos agrees, men are men. And I'll just append that to emphasize, trans men are men too.
Hell yeah.
There's an utter simplicity in that statement, but it too can be freeing. Once you understand other people as just that, people, and acknowledge their humanity and desert of moral respect, a lot of other bullshit falls away. They're not barbarians or aliens or migrants or any number of terms we use to stratify people based on our own perceptions of civilization and culture, neither of which are set in stone or inevitable. It's this mindset that allows Davos and his little conspiracy to save Edric. He views the boy as a person, not as a sacrifice or a way to get from A to B, even if B is as epic as awaking stone dragons. Davos finishes this chapter, tying together everything he had heard and learned, and all of that starts to trouble him. Yes, I do think mainly because a lot of these apocalyptic heraldings of Melisandre, whose power he does not deny, are starting to overlap with news from the north, but I think he's also starting to tremble at a plan in his mind, the formulation he's starting to see as Stannis' best hope of getting back in the game. As he ponders whether the Night's Watch knows that Stannis is licking his wounds, his mind has to circle back to the fact that Stannis needs men. And well, Northmen are men, be they wildlings or lordlings.
This is just the perfect way to end the chapter, tying Davos' literacy arc back into the struggle over the fate of Edric Storm, and putting all of it into context with what's happening at the Wall. George doesn't just tell us that reading is important and liberatory even depending on your perspective, he shows us in action. He's putting Davos in the position of the reader, trying to make sense of what he reads, again, like Melisandre with the flames. And I love the slow pace of this. Like, at first, Davos isn't really reading the letter, in the sense of internalizing the message. It's nothing but a puzzle. He's trying to prove he can read the content as secondary. There's dramatic irony here in that we already know what Maester Aemon is writing about, so the reader is in the position of rooting for Davos to make sense of it. Come on, come on, you're so close! And finally he does, that great moment when he suddenly realizes what he's reading. Like, this isn't just a puzzle, this is something to act on. This is part of his job. Hey, learning to read has already paid off. Later in the book, Davos will use this letter as a springboard to make an argument to Stannis about his philosophy of leadership. You have to demonstrate that you are worthy of being in charge, rather than just asserting that you're in charge. You have to save the kingdom to win the throne. But that's an argument he builds to, using his rhetorical skills as a politician. In the moment, in his head, Davos feels nothing but uncertainty and dread. The ambiguity here is really effective, allowing us to get a stronger sense of how Davos thinks by how he approaches these issues. He doesn't immediately go into big damn hero mode and fantasize about charging in with the cavalry to save the Night's Watch. Instead, he reflects that even Lord Asshole Florent had a point when he said that Stannis lacked the men to fight another battle. Davos himself has said the same thing. In contrast to what he tells Stannis later, Davos here thinks it's too much to expect Stannis to defend people who don't acknowledge him as king. Moreover, Davos doesn't take the letter's presentation of the wildlings at face value. Now his backstory as a smuggler comes into play. Part of his life in the black market of Westeros was trading with the wildlings, because the wildlings lack official access to resources south of the Wall. That gave Davos a different perspective on the Night's Watch for many people, because he saw them violently enforce the laws that keep the wildlings out. So even as the Watch is now the underdog against Mance, Davos doesn't think of the Watch as valiant knights first and foremost. To him and that old life of his, they were the cops. By helping the Watch, aren't we just resetting the status quo where the wildlings are non-people? That's something Jon will struggle with in A Dance with Dragons, including in his dealings with Stannis. The injustice of that status quo is that, as Davos and Pylo say, beautifully simply, men are men. It's not that the wildlings are all heroes. It's that they have the same proportion of heroes and villains as those south of the Wall, so why do we pretend otherwise? Why do we keep them penned up there, and why do we execute those who dare trade with wildlings like they would with anyone else? Even as Davos helps save the Night's Watch, he's still uncertain in this book about what he's fighting for, and that applies to the magical plot as well as the political one. Davos has this creeping feeling that Melisandre's big messianic narrative might be coming true around him. What if the wildling invasion is the precursor to the Long Night? What if this means she's right about Azor Ahai and Edric Storm? Now, all that doubt is in there in part just to distract the reader, so we don't realize what is clearly going to happen next, Stannis going north, but it's also true to character. As Davos tells Pylos, it's too troubling. He doesn't have all the answers. He admits that to Melisandre in his next chapter. Davos is too honest a man to pretend he can resolve all the ambiguities. He just tries to do the right thing anyway. So moving on into foreshadowing and groundwork, we have Melisandre breaking the news to Stannis here that no, just Robin Balin dying doesn't mean you automatically get to win the war. You're going to get false kings cropping up everywhere still, including from those two kingdoms. And the next false king for the Greyjoys is, of course, already Euron. But for the Starks, maybe Melisandre is glimpsing Jon in the flames as Robb's heir here. I always thought about the reason she might try to bring him back if she doesn't think he's Azor Ahai. Maybe she's like, no, you're supposed to be the next annoying king of the North at some point. I know R'hllor's not done with you. Maybe this vision is why she tries to bring Jon back.
Yeah, I don't really know. I think I always interpreted a little more metaphorically that it would just be people fighting over leadership of the North and less so sure. that. And I think there might be a throwaway line about maybe Roose Bolton having higher ambitions than even Warden of the North. So maybe perhaps it might be Roose that's referring to. And I'll always be sad we never got to see Stannis Baratheon versus Roose Bolton, the thrill in Manila on Game of Thrones. I would have loved that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Same here. So on to a theory and discussion. This is where Melisandre starts talking more about the stone dragon that she brought up towards the end of the last Davos chapter. She's very cagey about what exactly this means, how exactly it would work out specifically, and we don't see it, of course, since Davos sends Edric away. But I want to ask you what you think about how that, if that talk is going to pay off, despite Melisandre losing her her non-consensual blood donor this time around. Do you think that's ever going to pay off? There is that House of the Undying vision of a beast made out of stone. Do you think that's going to tie into this somehow?
Yeah, so I don't know if I'm just kind of out of date with my reading here. The last time I read Tumblr was about 2015. But I think the last sure. time I really settled on a conclusion here was that this was a roundabout way to refer to young Griff, who is posing as a dragon and with potential grayscale outbreak yeah. on his back. I kind of see that kind of being the stone dragon, like he literally turns to stone in the process. And that kind of stands in as the stone dragon. I don't actually envision anything that is a stone dragon coming to life at this point. If anything, it's retroactively applied to Daenerys's eggs, I would imagine. But I literally just do not see an actual like stone dragon coming to life. I imagine it being something more metaphorical or prophetic in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're supposed to be kind of teased and creeped out by the idea of the dragons on Dragonstone being real dragons. But I think that idea is more supposed to be luring Stannis onto something unspeakable more than it is reflecting a real reality. And yeah, I think the House of the Undying vision, I think young Griff is a good bet. Euron is another possibility, maybe given the tower part of the vision. But I don't think it ties into Stannis and Melisandre because I don't think they pull off even a temporary version of a stone dragon, even a lesser version of the beast they're talking about. I think when Melisandre burns Shireen, there's probably not going to be, I would bet there's not going to be any kind of metaphysical effect at all. Or if there is one, it'll be moderate, modest, like, melting the snow a little bit, like it did on the show.
Yeah, I think at first, maybe I got carried away and thought, oh, maybe she'll burn Shireen and then Jon wakes up or something epic like that. But I think the whole point is that it's not going to fix anything because all of a sudden, if burning Shireen means Stannis wins the war, the others are defeated, or our great hero comes back to life in terms of Jon, then it kind of complicates kind of the clear moral like proposition that George is laying out here through Davos and his point of view about burning Edric.
Yep, I think the wage is for it or nothing, that you sell your soul to gain the world, but you don't even gain the world as it goes. So that is going to wrap us up for episode on A Storm of Swords, Davos 5. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps people find us. If you haven't already, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits, including exclusive episodes every month and early access to our regular episodes. You can find us on Twitter or Instagram at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, or shoot us an email at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, @gmail.com. And you can find me at Poor Quentin on Twitter or Blue Sky.
And I'm Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb. We just restarted our coverage of The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. You can find our first episode out this week at My Brother, My Captain, My Podcast.
Hell yeah. And my next Lord of the Rings episode is going to be out next week for all of our $5 and above patrons. It's going to be covering Book 6, Chapter 7, Homeward Bound, as the hobbits gradually make their way home towards the Shire, taking their sweet time, but they're getting there. My latest Star Wars episode is out now for all of our $5 and above patrons, my third one on New Hope, covering the introduction or the reintroduction of Obi-Wan Kenobi in the first movie. And then next time in A Song of Ice and Fire, a couple weeks from now, we're going to be covering A Storm of Swords, John 7. in which the Fens attack Castle Black, and Jon has to watch the woman he loves die. Jon Snow could definitely use a vacation at this point, except, of course, that all of the other wildlings in the world are going to show up next. So even though Ygritte's death feels like it might be a climax of a book if George had written it differently, nope, Jon's got a lot more work to do.
Even by himself, it still might be a good idea for him to go back to that cave.
just a solo venture, you know. Just that's a sad thing to imagine, just go sitting outside the cave and Jon's just sitting there in the pool, just staring. Yeah, no, still might be better though. Still might have a better time. So thank you again for listening, and we will see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, Jon 7.